Well, my name is Daryl Durstein. I have a very faithful wife of 10 years and five children, three girls, two boys, that order. And back when I was single, I used to travel quite a bit. If the ushers would want to come up and take that handout. There's three of them here. Pass them out. Back when I was single, I used to travel some. And one day I was passing through an airport by myself, and I happened to pass into the gravitational field of one of those little airport bookstores, and I got sucked in. And while I was in there, this bright yellow book caught my eye, bright orange. And I thought, I found out later that's why they make books bright orange, just to catch your eye. But I picked it up and I took it to my airline seat, sitting in that little cramped seat, back in coach, probably at American Airlines. And I was reading and I forgot a great deal of what was in that book. But one quote, sort of, I can't get it exact, but one quote that has stayed with me was that we're having data thrown at us all day long, bits and bytes of data. But the problem is the human mind is not ideally set up to process data. The human mind is ideally set up to process stories. That's why if you have a speaker can come up and they can give you 35 points and they're wonderful, and you the next day you can remember three of them, and a month later you might can remember one. But if they tell you one story, you've got it. And so that's the way I wanted to go about it this morning. And I wanted to start with a story about a story. Once upon a time, a story was walking down the road. And as he walked, he was happy because it was a beautiful spring morning and the daffodils were nodding in the warm spring breeze and the dewdrops were still clinging to the blades of grass. And he was happy because he had gotten the call and he was going to Story Palace. Story Palace is where all good stories go to be published. That's how they achieve immortality. And he was happy because he was taking along all the things that made life worth living. He had a whole backpack full of them. And as he traveled, he thought of how worthless life would be if he hadn't had all his treasures with him. But he was happy because he did. And as he walked, he noticed lying beside the road something white. So he walked over and he looked at it and he said, what is that? Oh dear, I believe it looks like a bone. A bone? What a bone be doing lying out here by the road? Well, I should hurry on. So he was moving down the road. He was moving a little faster now. And for some reason, the breeze did not feel quite so welcoming as it did. And the rustling in the bushes he wondered about. But he also wondered if maybe his pack wasn't a little heavier than it should be. And he wondered if he shouldn't have brought so much stuff along. But the things in there were important. And as he moved down the road, he stopped and kept looking back. And he heard far back and back and back. He heard, oh, and he said, oh dear, what's that? And on the top of the next hill, he looked back, and far back and back over the top of the hill, he saw a long string of gray things, four-legged things, coming over the hill. He said, oh, dear, I do believe that looks like wolves. He said, well, what would wolves be doing out here on a beautiful spring morning? I must hurry. So he began to move faster and faster, but his back was heavy, and it kept banging against his backbone. And then he realized they were gaining on him, and they were gaining fast. He said, oh, well, what can I do? I got to get rid of some weight. So he began to reach into his backpack. He began to pull things out. He began to pull out conjunctions and just put periods in because that helped him move faster. And the faster he went and the more conjunctions he got rid of and chopped his sentence lengths down, he found he could pick up some speed. And he had a lot of exclamation points in there because exclamation points are exciting, but they're heavy. And next thing you know, he was throwing out whole handfuls of exclamation points. And he was getting this thing on the road, but they were still gaining on him. And he was trying to find what he could pull out of back there. And he got a hold of this prepositional phrase and he pulled it out and looked at it. He couldn't figure out what to do with it. Did it go at the beginning or the end of the sentence? And he didn't know either. So he just chunked it over his head and just kept running and running. And there was a big female wolf leading the pack. A big female wolf that had been leading his pack for many years, and she had a one eye missing and a few teeth gone on one side, and she was pulling the lead. And when she got that prepositional phrase, she jumped on her, and all the other wolves jumped on top of her, and they were, the fur was flying, and they were discussing this thing at the top of their lungs, and he was running and running. They couldn't figure out whether it went at the beginning or the end of the sentence either. And so he kept running and running. He finally got over the hill, and he got down, and he was so tired. But they were still way back there, and he couldn't even hear him anymore. They'd forgotten about him. He sat down by a stream, and he said, "That was too close. Well," he was sitting there trying to get his head clear, and he looked up, and there, far above him on the top of the hill, was a beautiful white palace. He said, "I see the story palace, the land of my dreams." And he got up and he put his shoes back on and he started up the hill. He was happy again. His back was lighter, but hell, maybe some of that stuff needed to go. And as he came up, there was a big rock in the middle of the road. So he edged out and went around this rock. And as he came around the other side, there, lying into the shade of a big oak tree, was a big brown bear. He said, a bear? Oh, dear. Nice bear. I've always thought bears look so good in the spring." And the bear picked his head up and looked at him. No, you stay right there. I'm just going around this way." And he thought about going back, but the palace was beckoning him. He wanted to be there so badly. And so he kept easing around the bear. And then the bear stood up. And it opened its mouth, and bone fragments fell out both sides from the bone he had been chewing. And he said, oh dear, look, you stay right there. I'm just going up this way." And he started to go, but the bear was coming too. So he went faster and faster, running up the hill. And the bear started after him. He could hear its padded feet and its claws scratching on the gravel behind him. But the hill was steep, and he was going as fast as he could. And he saw he was never. So he began to throw more stuff out of his pack. He began to throw out nouns because, he began to throw out adjectives because he found out if you have the right nouns, you don't need a lot of adjectives. And then he was really flying, but he found out he could start throwing out adverbs because when you got this much action going on, you don't need adverbs. And he was really being on it when he realized he still wasn't going to make it. And he said, "Oh, dear, there was only about two things left in his pack, and they were desperately important. He had this big block of a backstory that he had put in there. He needed it. And so he reached down, and he got it, and he pulled it out, and he looked at it, and it was beautiful. But the bear, he could feel its hot breath on his neck practically. So he threw that over his head, and then he reached down, and he got the only thing left was a big chunk of moralizing that he had saved for the very end. But he needed that because it was the whole reason the story was to exist. He couldn't give that up. And then he could feel it. He could actually feel his hot breath on his neck. He reached down, he grabbed it, and he pulled it out. He didn't even look at it. He couldn't look at it. No, he would never be able to let it go. And he looked up, and there was somebody holding the big oak door of the palace open. And he just threw that thing over his head. He didn't look back anymore. He just ran and ran and ran. And he fell across the threshold, and he heard the big oak door go boom behind him. And he was safe, but he was lying on the floor, sobbing and crying because he had made it. But he had made it with all that he had left behind, everything that he was bringing that was going to make him worth being there for. And they helped him onto a small couch. And they brought him a glass of lemonade. And he saw the person bring the glass of lemonade. And she was coming towards him in her long gray robe. And she was beautiful. And he looked at her. And timeless. That's the word. A timeless classic. And she came up and she laid her hand on his forehead and gave him a glass of lemonade. And she said, "You look really stressed." He said, "Oh dear, you don't know the half of it." He said, "I made it, but I gave it all up." He said, "There was these terrible wolves." She said, "Oh, we call them reviewers." He said, "The big bear." She said, "You mean the editor?" I am not a story. I'm a writer. I do not think editors are big bears, but I do think if you were a story, you might would feel that way. And of course, the inside joke on it is that the story wasn't worthy to make it to publication until he had been through all that. We can see that. The story could. But in storytelling, they say the first thing is you can't have a story until you have a problem. I think that's a little bit wrong. I used to tell my children that, and we're riding in the vehicle, and they would say, tell me a story. And I had them to, I finally, my other little girl piped up and she said, but you have to have a problem. That was my 5-year-old. Because I had gotten, sometimes I would tell them, hey, you figure out the problem. Why do I have to come up with all the problems? And I found a better way. There's something that predates the problem. We need to know who we're telling the story about. That's first. And the very second thing in plotting a story is, what does your character want? This is critical, because otherwise you're sort of threshing around. The tension in a story and in plotting a story comes from the desire of your character and what he wants. And he can want anything, but if you identify strongly enough with your character, his desire becomes your desire as a reader, and you begin to want the same thing, even if it's just winning a spelling bee, or maybe saving the world, or saving your neighbor. But we have to know what your story, what your character, who your character is, and what he wants. So what does your character want? Well, who is he? Well, he's a 21-year-old boy. What does he want? He wants a girlfriend. And that suggests the problems that you can put in his way to develop your story. Well, what's the problem? He's terribly shy. He's the one that sits way back there in the corner with his knees pulled together and his notebook on his knees, and he's kind of got his head down because he's a little bit afraid somebody might see him. This could be a problem. You look back at the story that I told, and who is a character? He's a story. Well, what does a story want? He wants published. What sort of things stand between a story and publication? Well, the reviewers and editors. But what we can see in that is what really stands between the story and publication is all the garbage he had in his backpack. And it wasn't until that had been peeled away that it was even worth publishing. Thank you. And so we have to know what your character wants. It doesn't even have to be what the reader wants, but we have to have something he can identify with. Now I'm going to go down over this. Actually, I need a copy of that one, the one with the long list. Actually, I need a copy of all of them. I didn't save one. Thank you. So I'm going to go down over this long list. We didn't need and spend an enormous amount of time on it. You do not have a story until something goes wrong, but as we pointed out before, it's more important to first know who your character is and what he wants. And the tension must keep mounting, or your story will stall. You can't have stories that just, they've got this big tension spike, and then they just drop off and they're just day-to-day events for days and days and days. You don't want to achieve the effect of watching a person get 8 hours of sleep by sitting there and watching them sleep for 8 hours. It doesn't work. You create tension by showing what the character desires or needs, and then creating things to keep them from getting what they want. Coincidences are how a story opens, not how they progress. Not how it progresses. In other words, you can start with any sort of inciting event, a car wreck or whatever, but you can't have your characters rescued that way. So you're just about to have the bad person get your character, or that wouldn't be a real great Christian theme probably. You're just about to have the bad thing happen, and all of a sudden, miraculously, somebody else walks in and just fixes it all. Your readers will say no. No, that's cheating, because it is cheating. If you had some way of showing that this character was on the road and there's a reason he's on the road to come save you, that can work. But you can't just have coincidences drop in. That's how real life works. It's not how stories are allowed to work. It's more important for us to feel empathy and attachment for a character, even for his flaws, and be awed by his cleverness. Some characters can be really flawed, and sometimes that's what makes them lovable. When you look at a character and, wow, he's OCD too. Ooh, poor man. Make your reader care about the main character. Show them what is happening. Don't tell them. Let them feel the threat of impending danger. Let them see the threat of impending danger. Don't let your character see it. Put the reader in his skin by using physiological symptoms. Their hands are sweaty. And this is particularly important because I was standing up and leading a, I was in a program one time, my school children were there, and I looked out over the crowd of people bigger than this, and I was okay. All of a sudden, I saw my big uncle back. He's a beard, and he's kind of a big, broad person, and a big built, and he was crying. And I mean, just that quick. I was just about crying, and I kind of yanked the brakes on. We're not going to do that. No, not up in front of people. But seeing him crying almost tripped me over the edge. That's the way we're made. We're empathical. If you see the character as his hands are sweating and he has a terrible desire to look back over his shoulder, and you're reading the story at 10 o'clock at night, you want the corner chair because there's nothing behind it. You speed up your climax, shorter paragraph, or punchier verbs and shorter words as attention increases. It's better not to let your character scream. Especially scream. Anything wild that they do can pull tension out of the story. It's been released. You don't really want to release that tension. Climax is not a time to describe or explain things. That had better be done, taken care of before now. If you're having your climax happen somewhere where it needs described, you better have been there before and have it described. When it's happening, you don't want to be describing things. Things must always get worse. We've created a moment where it seems like not all that can go wrong has gone wrong and nothing can possibly get worse, then it's time to move to resolution. Everything must be dictated by choice. A mentor or guide can direct, but he cannot make a choice for your main character. Nothing must undermine your main character from making the choices that drive the story forward. We don't want to read a story where circumstances bump the person this way, this way, and this way, and this is where they end up at. We want to see the person progress in their grow, and the only way to do that is by making choices and taking the consequences for what we have done. Never let your readers forget what your character wants. In other words, remind them through the story. Hey, he's going to Story Palace because he wants to be published. Remember, the story must be driven by choice. That's repeated. And it's in large caps because it's important. Your character must break out like a flower driving up through the warm spring ground, or he must rot underground like a dead bulb. He must either grow from the choices he makes or be destroyed by them. You do not want your character to start here, end here, and they have all this event, and he's the same person in the end that he's in the beginning. He needs to grow. There are exceptions to that. You have flat characters. For example, Sherlock Holmes is a flat character that he is the same person through all the stories. Most of our stories are based on a person growing in purity, growing in faith, and so most of the time we're going to want our characters to be what we call round character and develop over the storyline. Your main character must develop. I already touched on that. And these are the questions. What does he want, or is he trying to accomplish? What's standing in his way? What will happen if he doesn't overcome the obstacles to get what he wants? The stakes. What's going to happen? If he doesn't get the Story Palace, what's going to happen? He's going to end up being eaten. Simple enough. But the stakes need to be high enough to get your blood pressure up. They make blood pressure medication. Don't worry. Are the consequences for failing bad enough? We touched on that. How will he be matured or different if he does manage to accomplish his objective? Keep asking your character, what will you do in this situation? He might know. Ask yourself, if I've done everything I can to make the situation for this worse for this character by building tension. And when you get near the end, ask yourself, how can the story end in a way that will surprise the readers and yet be the most logical way? This is very commonly used in storytelling, in story workshops, but you want the reader to say, oh, I never saw that coming, but oh, absolutely, how it couldn't have ended any other way and made sense. That's the end you're looking for. And you may have to think about it for a couple weeks. When you get to that big climax, how am I going to get him out of this? Take some time off and think about it. As you create your scenes, is the next scene a result of the last one, or is it something too disconnected? This is a big one for people who plot their stories out on paper. Some people take a story, they find the character, they ask what he wants, and they wing it, and they're good at it. Other people plot it all out on paper. Either way can work great. I think it's probably a personality type thing. But people who plot to follow their character through life, seeing what he's going to do next, their stories can be very believable because each scene is based on the last one. But they can also be flat. If your character is just going from one thing to another and there's not enough tension built. And that's why for those of you who like to just wing a story, well, congratulations. The one thing we need to keep in mind is tension, tension, tension. Keep ratcheting it up. And what can get worse? What can possibly get worse? What can go wrong next? That was yesterday for me. I'll tell you that story at the end, maybe, if we have time. All right. But if you are plotting a story out on paper, scene one, scene two, scene three, these people are good at building tension often because the tension is in each scene as they develop, as they put it in the plot. But where they tend to fail is they don't have a strong enough link between this scene and this scene. They know they want them doing this here. They know they want them doing that here. And so they do it. And there's not a strong enough link. And the reader is thinking, why exactly did he go from here to here? What was his motivation again? So depending on whether you're winging it or whether you're plotting it, it's which question you need to pay attention to. Can we end our chapters the same way? Inevitable, but surprising. Do we need to go back and give my characters any special knowledge or possessions? You might get to the climax and realize, oh, he has to have a... Can't add it then. I'm sorry. You got to add it. Then go back somewhere else in the story and show him getting it, having it, putting it in his pocket, whatever. I feel a little bit like I don't know what time it is. What? It's 9:30. It's what time is it?
9:35.
9:35, and I have till what? 10:15. Okay. All right. Thank you. For example, let's say your person's out in the woods and they're lost and it's getting dark and it's cold and they're going to freeze to death and they discover a box of matches in their pocket. Wow! No. But you can have your character, well, it couldn't be getting dark, but it would be getting dark in a few hours. You could have your character, before he leaves and he's looking at the back of this power bar, and he can't read the fine print because he's got vision problems up close. So he pulls out his wallet and he gets out one of those little credit card size magnifying glasses, and so many G of carbs. Okay, puts it back in his wallet, puts it back in his pocket. He don't like glasses, but he carries it for that sort of thing. Now, when he's out in the woods, we've already showed you the little magnifying device. Now, when he's out in the woods and he's only got a few hours of sunlight left, he can pull that thing out, hold it up to the sun, get some dry tinder. He's got a fire. But don't just have him whip it out of his pocket, or your readers are thinking, no, that was too convenient. You can't do that. All right, if you're not sure what to do next, the same with skills. If you're not sure what to do next, put your character in a terrible position and see what he does to get out of it. He might surprise you, and you might have to think about it for a week or so. But don't let it be too trite. Go back to your story now. Have you foreshadowed any events that you did not bring to closure? Let's say you have, whatever the situation is, you have, you started a story, let's say you said, though it had only been 3 weeks since the house roof started leaking. Okay, that works. But that needs to be closed out somewhere down the line. And one way to do this, and I picked that up out of a book by Jane Cleland, is you can go at the beginning of it and you say, okay, this is a foreshadowing sentence. This needs closed. But how am I going to remember it needs closed? So you go to the beginning of the sentence and you put in a long string of capital A's, for example. 5 of them. Always use the same amount. And that way, every time you put in one of those sentences that's going to need closure later on, you can go into your search engine and you can put in 5 capital A's, boom, and there's all your sentences that need closed out. And you might say, well, I don't want to keep that one and that one, but I definitely want to keep these 3, but they need closed out. It's fine, but they need closed out. The story is over when the characters have all learned what they needed to learn, made the needed changes, and all the reader's questions have been answered. We don't want to continue on with the plot of our story after the story's over. All right, enough on that. Now, I want to talk about tension. Because there's an argument to be made. And it's made by, I think it's Stephen James in his book, Story Trumps Structure. This is the book you want, Story Trumps Structure, if you're writing by cause and effect and following through on it. This is where a lot of these ideas came from. Most of them are paraphrased, but this is a really good book on simply taking your character and following them through the story. So many times the people who write books about stories, I'm assuming, about how to write stories, are the type of obsessive people who want everything planned out ahead of time. And that works great for them. It's a wonderful way to go about it. But not all writers are that way. And so there's a book for you. Story Trump Structure. Now, let's go to tension. And he makes this quote in there. He said, there's this argument about whether stories are driven by character or whether stories are driven by plot. He says it's neither. Stories are driven by tension. All stories are tension driven. So we want to figure out, in plotting a story, how do you create tension? Let's have a story. So we follow our main character. Jane is getting out of her SUV, out of her Tahoe at the park in Central Florida. And she goes around, gets her three-year-old out of his car seat. He's kicking his feet and giggling. And she gets him out, and she's talking on her iPhone the whole time. She's like, we just got to the park right now. Yeah, that's what I thought too. And she's leading her little boy by the hand. And she sees a sign that's been marked over. What the deal is that somebody had been killed here by an alligator. But we're not worried because the Park Service has told us, under no uncertain terms, they got that gator 6 weeks ago. And they are assuring us he's gone. Well, she's leading her little boy down to the water, down the lane, and they go by this big pavilion. And in this pavilion, there's a park ranger, badged and so forth, giving a group of school children, early teens, lessons on hunter safety and proper gun use. Go on down the line, and she gets to the park, and she turns her child loose on the grass. So he's playing in the grass, and she is talking on her phone, and she is talking to her sister in Wyoming. And she says, yeah, that's what I thought too. You know, no, I don't know. Yeah, that's what my husband says too. He's always saying that I let the children go, run a little bit too much. I get too bound up in the phone conversation. But let me tell you, I can sympathize, because when I'm bound up at the house all day with the children, sometimes I just got to get out. I got to talk to somebody. I got to have an adult voice. And I mean, he's at work all day, and he talks to all those people, and I gotta call somebody. I agree with that. So you've got the same problem. Meanwhile, the little boy is down by the creek, by the lagoon. And he's poking his stick in the mud, and the water is cold, and the mud is squishy. And there's a smell of rotting vegetation drifting out of the swamps from generations of plants that have died. And far across the lagoon, it's a big log floating in the water. Yeah, she said, no, I didn't get the purse bought. I never got my 31 in order yet. But let me tell you what happened to at Sewing Circle the other day. And we were having such a great time. And then Sister Jane, I don't know what she was thinking, but she said, but she brought up that issue about who to elect for the food committee. And I thought we had settled that issue. And I didn't know what to say. It just got kind of quiet, and everybody's just sewing, waiting for somebody to say something. And then my aunt chimes in, and she says, real nicely, well, I thought we had settled that issue. And she turned on her just that quick and said, I got to thinking about that later, and I just don't think that we need to have the vote next week. I need some more time to think about it. So I think we're having one next month. And the little boy's poking in the water with his stick, and she turns and she looks out over the water, and she sees this log floating in the lagoon about halfway across the lagoon, and she says, that's not the way it was. Yeah, it happened like that at our room too. I really need to get off the phone. I suppose I really should listen to my husband more on this, but I've got a story I need to tell you yet. And the little boy feels cold. I think it's because he's got his feet splashing in the muddy water. Maybe it's because of the breeze blowing out of the swamp. But he feels cold, like something is watching him. And he looks back at his mom, and she's got her back turned, trying to find a little better cell service. And she's going on and on about something that happened at the last church social. And she starts to walk away. She turns and looks back. She's not very far away. Everything's great. There's a man down the line about 30 yards, forking some mulch under some bushes. You can hear the sound of the hunter safety class up the hill drifting down to her. She can smell the smell of rotting vegetation. She can see a big snapping turtle sitting on a log at the water's edge that may be as old as her grandfather. She doesn't register any of it. The little boy looks across the water and stamps his feet. The water flies. And he notices a log floating about 20 yards away. And she turns back and she says, "Yeah, I really should go for the third time, but..." And then, just then, the whole lagoon blows up. And the little boy is looking out across the water when some primeval monster on short, stumpy legs and a big tail comes roaring up out of the water. Its mouth open in a long white teeth. And the wife turns back just in time to see her 3-year-old running up the bank in his dirty shorts and t-shirt, his mouth wide open, his eyes terrified, and right behind him, a 12-foot alligator gaining at twice the speed he is. And she screams and throws the phone away, and it flips over twice and lands face down on a framing on a landscaping camber and cracks. And her sister on the other end says, "Hello? Hello?" And she starts to run towards the child, and she sees she won't make it. So we get a little bit of tension. Foreshadowing. Let's just go back and dissect it like we would a frog. Foreshadowing. The sign that they had put up about don't going too close to the water because there had a gator danger. It's marked over. They got the gator. They're sure of it. Are your readers sure of it? Not a chance. Character. Who is the character? What's the little boy? But it's the mother, actually. And don't get any ideas about our marriage. I'm the one talking on the phone in La La Land. My wife is the one keeping track of things. So I didn't want to cast a slant there. The mother is clueless. And she's out of it. Not so much clueless as she's not paying attention. She's not here. And the unseen danger, we saw the log. It was out there. Now it's up here. We know what the log is. We got a real good idea. We see the danger and we're like, "Put the phone down." She is not here. The tension comes from us seeing the danger, then nothing that nobody else does. I did not have a red herring in this story, but red herrings can be wonderful. And that's when you build up tension using something like the wolf getting closer and closer. And that's not a good example. Let's say something is getting closer and closer. You keep seeing it. You keep seeing it. It's getting closer to your character, and it's dangerous. We feel the danger. And then at the last minute, the danger arrives, and it's something else. That's a good thing to do, because it builds tension while at the same time distracting us from the real danger. There's not one in this story, but there can be. Environmental. There's a certain sense of swamps that are just a little bit creepy. Create your setting in such a way that you get some rotting vegetation smells in cold, dark water, whatever it is. There's a reason they don't set most ghost stories in the middle of a carnival at 12 in the afternoon. Psychological and physiological. What is your character feeling? What are they thinking? And that's where I talked about getting in your character's skin. Well, that business about somebody sneaking up behind you. We all feel it, I think. How many of you have been out after dark and just needed to look behind you? Yeah, that's pretty common. But men don't do that. We're a lot braver. Let me tell you a story about that. My friends worked in the Canadian bush pulling logs, and they would come out miles and miles and miles on gravel road with these big log trailers. They had a log trailer, and then they had an attachment on the back, and they had a whole another log trailer behind that. They were pulling a tag. So this was a long train of a load. And when they would come out miles and miles on the gravel road, in the middle of the night, cold, no, in the middle of nowhere, the wilderness, they would tee into the main road, and there was nothing there either. They would pull up the main road. Now they had to get out of the truck. Naturally, they were men. They didn't mind this. But they had to get out of the truck in a cold, dark night in the middle of the Canadian wilderness and walk around, walk down the load and check and make sure nothing's sticking out. So they get out of the truck, he said, and he would get out of the truck and he would start walking back, and the truck's getting further and further away, and you can hear a hydrogen back there, but it's getting quieter and quieter. And he'd walk, 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 check, 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 all the way to the back of the load. By the time you got to the back, you're a long ways away from your truck. Felt like it. And look, everything looks good. There's nothing out here. So you turn around and start walking back. But you needed to walk faster and faster. And by the time you hit the running board, you had it. You had it in the wind. You were moving. But this is the sort of things men might not admit. But one day he was fairly candid. One day he was talking to another truck driver at the shop. He said, I got this thing, you know, where I get to the back of the load and I start front and I don't know. I just got to go. Got to go faster. I end up running before I get to my truck. And the driver says, really? You know, I do the same thing. We're looking at each other like, wow, we admitted this to each other, man. I don't know what they were thinking. There's this old mechanic that works here in the shop. Let's go ask him what he ever did it. Maybe. So they went over and they said, hey, look at this thing. I don't know exactly how they said it. I wasn't there. You know, we get in the back of our load, and you pulled a lot of loads out. We thought we'd just ask you what you thought. Have you ever ran? He said, of course. Because if you don't, it'll get you. Some of these human tendencies are so ingrained in our psyche that if we can put them in our characters, our readers will feel them too if it's done well. Don't say, he was afraid. What does that mean? It could mean anything. He was nervous about standing up in front of a writer's conference. There was a bear behind him. What's it mean? But when I tell you he needed to quit, to stop every 10 yards and look behind him, I've been there. In fact, hey, I mean, not everybody makes 10 yards. Psychological and physiological. What are they thinking? What they're feeling? And the last one is exceedingly powerful, and that's isolation. As long as the game warden would have been standing right there, and a big 300-pound man with a gun on his belt would have been fishing right there, and the mom would have been right there, and the man with the pitchfork would have been right there, it wouldn't have felt so bad. The fact that the mom is walking away, and the man with the pitchfork's down there, and the game warden's way up the hill, and the little boy's by himself at the edge of the water. Isolation, and there's all grades of isolation. There's spiritual isolation. I've seen that happen. One of the boys he started coming to our church. He made a commitment, and he was nice. He was a nice boy, community boy. And I said, and then he started working with some other men outside the community. And I said to him, I said, Brandon, I don't know if this is a good idea. I'm a little bit worried about you, Brandon. Oh, I'll be fine. I know what you're saying, but it'll be okay. I'm okay. And he fell away in just a couple months. Spiritual isolation is very dangerous. There's isolation, physical isolation, where we're by ourselves. There's emotionalized and social isolation, being alone in a crowd. That can be very alone. Isolation works. It's a consistent way of building tension into a story. Now, let's look at credibility. The dark horsemen of non-credible stories. Lack of causality. Everything must flow logically and naturally from what has come before. In the same way, your character's reaction must not be out of proportion to the inciting incident. We really want Joe to get really mad and start throwing rocks, so we have this person say this comment about him, but there's too big a gap between what the person said to him and what he did back. That's another way to lose causality. And it can happen in real life. One day I was standing in my office. Let me back up. Let me tell the story from the bird's eye view, the perspective of what happened. Two of our workers working back behind the shop. One of them was stacking boards. One of them was building mats. And they got to talking. And one of them was a husky man. And he was strong. And he was swinging a hammer. He was running a drill. And the other man, he was thinner, but maybe taller. And they got into a discussion, and the big man, who was a very good worker, didn't get into scraps with anybody, said something that for some reason irritated the tall or thin man. His name was Willis, the thin man. And it made him mad. And he walked over and he started stacking boards again. He came back, he said, "Look, I don't like what you said. And he's like, "Hey, I wasn't even talking about you. You misunderstood me. I was talking about somebody else. Excuse me. Well, I don't like it. What? I wasn't talking about you. Well, I'm upset about it." But, wow, whatever. Larry went back to and started building mats. Willis turned around, walked away, up across the mill yard. He walked 120 yards up under the other mill. I stepped it off later, something like that. He walked up under the other mill, and we kept the machete laying there on the ground. It had just been sharpened. Picked up the machete and turned around and started walking back. And our sawyer was up in the saw cabin and looked down and thought, "Oh, I wonder why he needs a machete all my way." Once in a while, he saw him get the machete. He thought, "Well, once in a while, they can't get a pack of lumber open. They use a machete and just whack the straps off the works. He must need it for that." So he's walking back with the machete. He walked 120 yards back. Came around the corner, and the other man pinned up between the mat, and there was not really any good place to go. Got in his face, and the big man saw that he had the machete, and he tried to take it from him, and he started swinging it, threw his arm up. Big man threw his arm up. First one deflected off his coat. The second one hit him right here, all the way across, cut a bunch of the tendons across the back of his hand, and as he went, the big man grabbed the thinner man with this hand, tried to neutralize the situation, or he was angry at that point, and went to grab him with the other hand, and he couldn't. And he looked down and his hand was just hanging there like that. And he turned around and he came walking back up to my office. And I'm in the office, talking with some truck. And I look out and Larry's standing there on the deck. And he kind of had the door open, I looked out and I'm like, "Hey, I'll be with you in a minute." And he's standing there, he's holding his hand up. You know how the skin is kind of tight across the top of your hand right here? And you bend it down. Well, if you cut across, it gaps open. It was just standing full of blood. And I looked out and went, "I've got to go." So I went running. I went out. I thought he'd been hurt on a machine. Meanwhile, the thin man, Willis, is standing there, right there too, running his mouth. I didn't understand what the situation was. I wasn't reading. It didn't even occur to me that he'd attack him. But I said, "We can get you to the hospital." Meanwhile, the big man, Larry, he's walking around and looking in the back of my pickup. And I thought, he's going in shock. He's big. I'm not that big. I can't carry him out of here. And I also saw, and Willis was standing there running his mouth. Da-da-da-da-da. "You need to put some pressure on that." I threw my coat over it, which was a bad move. But walked over, opened my truck door. Meanwhile, Larry's just kind of looking around, and Willis is running his mouth, and I don't know what's happening here. But for some reason, he is aggravating the situation. And I pointed at him, I said, "Go!" And he did after some, we'll get into that. But he went. And I took Larry by the shoulders. He's considerably bigger than I am. I took him by the shoulders real gently like he would a child because I thought he was going into shock. And I turned him around and I put him in my truck. I said, "We gotta go." And I drove to the hospital. It was like a mile and a half away. If you're going to tell this story as a fictional story. That wouldn't work. There's not enough difference between the cause and the effect, between what caused the man to get mad and what he did about it. Unless, we need some characters like this in our story sometimes because they're real. Unless we tell the reader somehow, we don't probably just want to do an info dump, something along the lines of two workers afterwards, well, I mean, I never saw it coming. What was he thinking? I mean, why did he? Then we understand this was unusual. But don't just have some big event happening from this little inciting act incident and then say, well, that's what happened. Your reader's thinking, no. And who? What normal person would do that? We need to explain it wasn't a normal person. We need to explain. Lack of unity. Everything matters. There's no room for useless information. Chekhov's gun, they refer it. If you show a gun on the wall, he said, and I think it was the first act, it better go off in the middle act. Don't just include useless information because it's pretty. Cut it away and cut it away. If you're going to show somebody something, the longer you talk about it, the more importance it has to the story. That's another from Henry James. He said, every word you write is a promise. And the more words you write, basically, the more words you write about something, the more importance it becomes. And you can't just drop it then. You either got to cut it out or you got to cut its importance down. But you cannot simply create something, have a gun hanging on the wall, and we talk about this gun, and then nothing happens. Doesn't work. Works in real life, but in stories are almost by definition paring away everything that's not story. A lack of consistency in your character. This relates back to number two. A character must be consistent throughout the story, or we must tell the reader that this character is inconsistent. Don't let them think you created an inconsistent character by accident. We all know of people who run hot and cold, and they're here one day and they're there another, and you never know what to expect. At least acknowledge a husband and wife talking after the children went to bed. I don't know what to do with Sandra. One day I'm around her and everything's wonderful, and I think the relationship's on the mend, and the next day everything's back to zero. I don't understand. And he said, yeah, I noticed that too. Now your reader are thinking, okay, that's the way Sandra is. They're not thinking, what is this writer doing? The descriptions are given in a way that normal people would not notice them. I think, I may have pulled this from Stephanie Leinbach. All right. Walk into a room, what do you see? Well, the interesting thing is boys and girls see different things. Boys can actually be remarkably blind. They call it male pattern blindness. You walk in, you look in the fridge. Where is it? It was in the wrong color bottle. Here a while back, my wife said, she told me where to find it. She wanted the Hair Detangler spray. Okay, so I went to Food Lion. I found the right section. I stood there and I looked. And it was not there. It was in a green bottle, she said, and I looked, I found the right section, it was in with the same name brand products, and it was not there. Walked away, came back, I think, maybe, looked. Finally, I found it right in front of my face. It was in a blue bottle. Now, the bottle that she had been using was a green bottle, but they had changed the color. It was right there, but because I couldn't see it, because it wasn't the right color, and men tend to be very focused like that. And then I'm looking for a green bottle, and nothing on the rack exists, you know. So we look at every kind of bottle, but we didn't see the blue bottle for some reason. Another man said he had the same experience with a dictionary. His wife, he asked the wife, he said, where's the dictionary? Oh, it's in there on the nightstand. He walked in, look at the dictionary was not on the nightstand. Walked back out. So what's going on? I can't find the dictionary. What's on the nightstand? Finally, she got it. She walked in there, looked, there, on the nightstand. It was a different color than he was expecting. Same deal. Men walk into a room and they see the sound system or the woodwork in the cabinets or whatever. And women see something entirely different. So the descriptions need to be given in a way that your character would see them. And number six, the spiritual truths do not resonate. I think sometimes what can happen in Christian stories is we know we want to write a story for CLP, and that's wonderful. We're going to do something for the Lord. What can we think of? Oh, yeah, I've got a problem. Sure, yeah, that sounds just like a story I would read in CLP. So they write it down, and they send it in, and it does. It does look like a story that maybe has been published. But the problem is that story's been published too many times. And we've gotten tired of it. What we need is something that resonates. And what can happen... I think what can happen to an editor is they get a lot of the same type of thing, and they have to figure out What am I going to do with all this? They want something, some new lesson, or something that's simply deep. It's really easy to write shallow stories. They say that which is most private is most common. And writing a deeply story that will resonate deeply with your readers, maybe about what they call like opening a vein and opening a vein and getting to work, letting your blood flow. All right, now I want to tell you about yesterday. Talking about how things are getting worse, I have one more point I want to make here in this. I have a 2011 Chevy Traverse, 194,000 miles or something. On the way up here yesterday, we're coming and we left at 10 o'clock in the morning. We're driving up. We get just below Petersburg, and all of a sudden, the wife's driving, and it starts going, this is not a good sound. This is not a hopeful get to CLP in time sound. This is, it's one of those places you've got concrete barriers on this side, concrete barriers on that side. We drove it about another mile. We would have driven it further probably, but it didn't. And it died. And my wife is trying to drive. So I don't have any power steering. Well, I know what that means. You don't have an engine. I said, you need to get over. Well, do we have clarity? I said, you need to get over. There was a little teeny exit right there. And she went over and coasted off just off the exit. And there was nothing there. Just a big government facility with a fence around it where they keep the salt and the calcium to put on the road. And it was all locked up. There was nothing there. There was anything within walking distance. So I got out, took the radiator cap off. This is not good. Stuck with the cap back down. But it didn't squirt out real bad like it should. You would think if it was overheated. Look, and it was 140 degrees on the thermometer. So I let it cool down, and I tried it. And it started to crank and like trying to run. Checked the oil, checked the water. Water was full. Oil was clear amber. Brand new. Had a brand new Mobil 1 oil filter. I can see it down there. It was still full of Mobil 1, full synthetic, full mileage, some of the better oil you can put in a vehicle, and high mileage, and it was toast. So I called the car rental place. I'm like, hey, I need you to bring me a car. Meanwhile, I'm talking back to my father-in-law, and he's talking to his brother who lives in Roanoke Rapids, who's working in Roanoke Rapids, and he says, I've got a truck and trailer. I'll come rescue. You know, being a Mennonite is wonderful. It really is. I read a story in Wee Lambs a while back. It's really, really struck with me. And you know how you can have that maybe a fair amount of Now Mommy Must Punish You stories. This one wasn't. But whoever wrote it, I appreciated it because it was a story about a family getting ready for supper, and there's a snowstorm going on outside, and this another Mennonite traveler is in the area, and they're bound up on the freeway, and the freeway's closing down, and they said, hey, can we come for supper? Yeah, we'll put extra plates on the table. So they brought him in, and they had supper, and they stayed the night, and it was beautiful. Because that's what Christianity really is all about. It's not all about now mommy must spank you. There was no bad problem, you know, where this person got into trouble. It was just a beautiful little story about Christians acting like Christians. Anyway, side note. He's coming up to pick me up. So I call the rental place. Could you bring me a car? And you get on the phone, and we are a family-owned business, and the family-owned business, we think there's some advantage in being a family-owned business, and we will deliver a car. We will deliver a car to your place of business. We will deliver a car to your house. Oh, great. This is the thing. I called him. Oh, no. We won't deliver a car to you. You're beside the road. You've got to give us an address. Like, I've got a family. Well, no. Company policy, no. We can't deliver a car to you beside the road. Could you walk to a gas station? There's no gas station. I'm sitting here beside the road. There's a big government building over here. The gate chain shot. No, I can't give you an address. Oh, we can't help you then. Then a cop showed up. The story's getting worse, right? Cop shows up and he comes up and stands by my wife's window. I need to see your driver's license. So I pulled out my driver's license and gave him to me. He was polite. I'm going to make fun of him. He was polite and he went back to his car. He said, now listen. He said, I'm going to have to call a tow truck. I said, I've got a friend coming. He's going to be here now. I'm going to pick the truck on. We need him. No. I understand your situation. I can't do that. We're going to have to call a tow truck. We're going to have to get you towed. It's going to cost you something, but there's really no other way about it. You're at the wrong place. We can't do that. So he took my license back and was sitting in his car. And I got out and I walked back to him and said, this thing is locked up. But it's freed up enough. I think it'll run. I said, if I would drive it a little bit. Well, he said, if you can get right down around the corner here under the bridge, then that'll be fine. I said, okay. He said, stay on the shoulder. Okay. So I went, jumped in the vehicle, cranked it up, drove it down around the corner and pulled it under the bridge. He came, gave me his driver's license, my driver's license back, shook my hand, and left. Of course, it still wouldn't bring me a car. The bridge doesn't have an address either. After a while, my guardian angel was acting as my good Samaritan, showed up and picked me up and took me up to find a car rental. I told my wife and sister, I said, there are two types of very dangerous people in this world. People who will not obey rules and people who obey rules to the letter. They are both inherently evil. No, that's the truth. Everything Hitler did in Germany was legal. All these people that stood there and shot Jews all day long were required to do so by law. A moral person must selectively break rules and laws and policies in order to be a moral person. I know you're saying, well, where are you going with this? Our ancestors understood it well. You can either obey the laws of God or you can obey the laws of man. And the people that were us, they were sitting there in the synagogue, and they said to Jesus, are you going to heal? Is he going to heal on the Sabbath day? Is he going to do it? Yes, he was going to do it because it was the right thing to do. The real problems we can give our characters that are hard is not a choice of do I buy the bad DVD or don't I buy the bad DVD. Those stories have their place and we need them. The real problem comes in at, do I do the bad choice or the worst choice? What I mean by that is, do I sometimes do something that may be going against advice on one hand in order to do what God would require of us on the other hand? For example, you get into a conflict and the church is requiring one thing of you and your family's requiring another thing. Those are the hard choices that can resonate with people. And those are things that we should consider putting in our stories once in a while because they're real. There are a class of people that will just try to get away with things. There's another class of people in our churches, young people, that really care. They really do. And they want to do the right thing. But it becomes extremely confusing if they want to listen to their father, maybe he's not a Christian, maybe he is, and they want to listen to the church. These are the hard questions that they face. And are we going to ever write stories with plots that answer their questions? We have just a little bit of time left. Anybody want to fire a question away? Now's the time.
What happened with the elevator?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't finish the story. But this is my opinion. She can get to the child maybe before the alligator takes it back into the water. She can delay things a little bit. There is a big husky man over here with a pitchfork. There is a game warden up the hill with a gun. If she can delay that, this won't turn out pretty, but it might turn out everybody might live. Some stories don't turn out. What? I'm sorry?
Maybe she'll lose herself right now.
Maybe. Anybody else?
Could you define for sure the difference in physiology and psychology?
I'm not sure I even used the right words. I'm not a medical doctor. But I was talking about the difference between what we feel, like our hands are sweating, we feel that prickle up the back of our neck, and we feel the cold wind, which actually feels colder than it is, that feeling. Versus what's happening inside our heads, such as, is there somebody in the next room? Am I going to be able to get help? That sort of questions. One is a thinking process. The other is actually our body organs responding to the stress of the moment. We feel it. It's visceral. It is actually our body, not just our brain. It's not our thought process or body answer. Any more? What?
It actually would be really easy to put a red herring into that story. If you have that log floating and you have reader's attention directed on that log. It's not actually an alligator, but up the hill, they're actually doing target practice with these children, and a gun gets misfired in the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm.
and somebody gets hurt. Maybe even she gets hit because she's walking toward them without thinking. So it'd be very easy to work a red herring into that story.
Mm-hmm. And red herrings are beautiful. I'm not sure if this exactly qualifies as a red herring or not, the one I'm getting ready to tell you, but I thought it was cute. I'm going to put myself out on a limb here for just a second because I think I pulled this from one of Sheila Petrie's stories about the toad in the house. And she tells about how the toad was lost in the house, and they're looking for the toad, and they're looking for the toad, and they may have turned the furniture over. I don't remember what all they did. And they couldn't find the toad. And then, if I remember right, she drops in that they were doing cherry tomatoes this day. Is that right? And then she's coming down the steps, I think maybe with the baby, in the middle of the night with the light off, and she steps on something and she feels it load up and pop under her foot. And after all the dramas is coming up, her husband comes running and flips on the light, if I remember correctly, and there on the step is a very dead cherry tomato. And I liked it. I mean, yeah, this is nice. Okay, I think our time is here. I wanted to say one last thing quick, besides thanking you so much for paying attention and laughing at the right places and that sort of thing. I was to a library once, a historic library, and they were passing around these old books, like multi-century-year-old books. I'm thinking, you mean they let people touch those? And since then, I've managed to acquire three of them, four or so. And I brought them along because if you love history and you're a sensor type person who loves to touch things and to hold things, that George Washington was alive. George Washington was being inaugurated president when it was done. They're here. Come up. Hand them. Pick them up. This is about 1790. It's a folio Bible in two volumes. And this book goes way back to the days of the Ephraim Cloister. It's the second ever Mennonite book ever written and produced in the United States. Don't be too scared of them. They won't blow up. They made books really well back then. So if you want to handle a book like that, come up, flip through it, and level them. Thank you.